way government regains the trust of its citizens is by telling the truth. There is no other way, no shortcut.
I call upon our government to open up like the Belgians have, the French have, Brazilians have, the Argentines, the Mexicans have all released their files. It's about time now that we do the same thing and become a part of this planetary community.
It is way past time for all of us to know what our own government knows instead of being kept in the dark by a policy of denial.
The last time that Congress held a hearing addressing the extraterrestrial issue was 1968, 44 years of sightings ago. In those 4.5 decades, hundreds of thousands of new sightings have taken place. Government agency witnesses have come forward. Media coverage has expanded. Hundreds of documentaries have been produced. Thousands of books have been written. And yet the United States Congress has remained silent. So for a period of 5 days, at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C., 2 blocks from the White House, 12 blocks from the Congress of the United States, we're going to conduct a citizen hearing on disclosure of an extraterrestrial presence engaging the human race. 40 to 50 witnesses of high rank and station, from military, from agencies, possibly from intelligence services, along with the top researchers in the world, will give 30 hours of testimony to 5 former members of the United States Congress.
So maybe the citizens' hearing has a chance to try to leverage open some of the truth about the fact that we're not alone in this universe, that we might actually begin to look at what we really are, what the true history of this planet is, and that might be what gets us into a future without self-destruction.
The motto of the citizen hearing is, if Congress won't do its job, the people will.
Greetings, everybody. Welcome to Galactic Roundtable, the countdown for disclosure. I hope you'll meet me at the National Press Club, April 29th to May 3rd, so we can watch this great event happening before our eyes. So today, we're going to break from the programming that we had planned, and I have a special presentation for you. I'm going to release this video later today on YouTube, and I want it to go viral because this is what we're looking forward to after full galactic disclosure. So I want to give a presentation now on Nisara Law, from beginning to end, how it became a law. Enjoy this, everybody. Thank you.
On GalacticRoundtable.com, we have a family of nearly 5,000 members from over 186 countries.
Oh boy, technical difficulty, sorry. Here we go.
GalacticRoundtable.com, we have a family of nearly 5,000 members from over 186 countries. We have had 3.6 million hits in about the last year and a half. We get about 19,000 hits a week, and we have had 102,000 views of the videos we've produced on the Galactic Roundtable channel of YouTube. These programs will be posted on YouTube as well. One feature of GRT is the blog where we post the news. Each week I'd like to discuss the Earth current events. We are watching the end of duality on Earth, and it is quite a show. We take in this news, and it changes it. We send the violet flame, as Saint Germain has taught us, and it transmutes it back to love. We will raise the vibration of Earth by doing this, and there will come a day very soon when nothing that is less than love will be able to sustain its life form on Earth. I would like to share the research about Nisara Law as compiled by Nancy Detweiler. I was talking to a friend this week who said when she heard me talk about Nisara, she thought it was a spiritual entity I was in contact with. I was surprised this very experienced woman did not know Nisara was a law that had not been enacted. She said, when you expose such egregious acts, one should have and dissimulate to the people a plan of action to rectify the wrongs. Otherwise, you can be staring down a loaded shotgun. I completely agree. I assured her I felt I had been staring down a loaded shotgun for more than 2 years, as my life has had verbal and physical threats constantly because I am getting the word out. Nassar Law was authored by around 20 members of Congress, including Harry Reid, Nancy Pelosi, Barney Frank, Dennis Kucinich, Ron Paul, Maxine Waters, Charlie Rangel, and Bernie Sanders. I told her the only plan I have is to be there every day to tell the truth about what's happening and ask folks to join together spreading the truth. Before I begin Nancy's research, I want to make an aside. Nancy is a big fan of the Dove. If you know who that is, I will simply say I do not advocate for her or the work she did. She was involved in dark dealings and has been shared by Mother Sekhmet, although now she has passed on. May she be in peace. This information is very well documented, and I feel it is of the utmost importance. The history of Nasara, the National Economic Security and Reformation Act, compiled by Nancy Detweiler, Masters in Education, Masters in Divinity, posted on August 17, 2011. 1892, bankers adopted their Bankers' Manifesto of 1892, which it was declared, "We the bankers must proceed with caution and guard every move made, for the lower order of people are already showing signs of restless commotion. Prudence will therefore show a policy of apparently yielding to the popular will until our plans are so far consummated that we can declare our designs without fear of any organized resistance." The Farmers Alliance and Knights of Labor organizations in the United States should be carefully watched by our trusted men, and we must take immediate steps to control these organizations in our interests or dispute them. The courts must be called to our aid. Debts must be collected. Bonds and mortgages foreclosed as rapidly as possible. When, through the process of the law, the common people have lost their homes, they will be more tractable and easily governed through the influence of the strong arm of government applied to a central power of imperial wealth under the control of the leading financiers. People without homes will not quarrel with their leaders. 1907 to 1917. In order to warn Americans, the 1892 Bankers Manifesto was revealed by U.S. Congressman Charles A. Lindbergh Sr. from Minnesota before the U.S. Congress sometime during his term of office between the years of 1907 and 1917. Remember, everybody, they stole his son from his house to try to discredit him and manipulate him. 1910. John E. DiNardo, professor of public policy and economics at the University of Michigan, writes in his article, "The Federal Reserve Act." On the night of November 22, 1910, a small group of surrogates of the most powerful bankers of the world met under the veil of utmost secrecy. Over the next few weeks, these men would perpetrate, under the orders of their masters, perhaps the most colossal and devastating fraud ever inflicted upon the American people. This ultra-secret fraud is known as the Federal Reserve Act of 1913. The Federal Reserve Act of 1913 concocted legislation to be foisted upon the People's Congress of the United States that empowered and commissioned this secret cabal of world-dominant bankers to print United States currency, a usurpation of our Constitution's explicit etiquette empowering only United States government to print and coin currency. This world banking empire used their stolen power to print and into thin air paper currency, which in no way represents the gold and silver reserves that the authentic currency is supposed to represent. 1913. The Federal Reserve Act of 1913. Complete text of the act may be seen at www.llsdc.org. As I read these websites to you, you can find them on galacticroundtable.com under the tab called Nisara at the top of the page. 1933 to 1934. Prior to 1933, Federal Reserve notes were backed by gold. This changed with the new law. Congressional Record, March 9, 1933. On H.R. 1491, page 83. Under the new law, the money is issued to the banks in return for government obligations, bills of exchange, drafts, notes, trade acceptances, and bankers' acceptances. The money will be worth 100 cents on the dollar because it's backed by the credit of the nation. It will represent a mortgage on all the homes and the property of the people of the nation. The Banker's Manifesto ties in with the U.S. Senate, document number 43, 73rd Congress, first session, 1934, which states, "The ultimate ownership of all property is in the state. Individual so-called ownership is only by virtue of government, that is, law, amounting to mere user, and use must be in acceptance with law and subordinates to the necessity of the state." 1970s, the Federal Land Bank illegally foreclosed on farmers' mortgages all throughout the Midwest and South. In each of these cases, the farmers were defrauded by the banks with the approval of the Federal Reserve System. These court cases would eventually become known as the Farmer Claims Program. 1978, an elderly ranch farmer in Colorado purchased a farm with loan from the Federal Land Bank. After he died, the property was passed on to his son, Roy Schwarzinger, Jr., who was a retired military general. Soon after, a Federal Land Bank officer and federal marshal appeared on his property and informed him the bank was foreclosing on his farm, ordering him to vacate within 30 days. Without his knowledge, his deceased father had signed a stipulation which reverted the property back to the Federal Land Bank in the event of the borrower's death. Outraged, Roy E. Schwarzinger Jr. filed a class action lawsuit in the Denver federal court system. The suit was dismissed on the basis of incorrect filing. This prompted Roy Schwarzinger's investigation into the inner workings of the banking system. 1982, Roy Schwarzinger was given a contract by the U.S. Senate and later Supreme Court to investigate banking fraud, but because he was under a strict non-disclosure order, he was not allowed to tell the media what he discovered. In the late 1980s, he began sharing his knowledge with others, including high-ranking military personnel who helped him bring about a class-action lawsuit against the federal government. The first series of these lawsuits began in the mid-1980s. When William and Shirley Bakersville of Fort Collins, Colorado, were involved in a bankruptcy case with First Interstate Bank of Fort Collins, who was trying to foreclose on their farm. At a restaurant, their lawyer informed them that he would no longer be able to help them and walked off. Overhearing the conversation, Roy Schwarzinger offered his advice on how to appeal the case in bankruptcy court. So, in 1987, they filed an appeal, case number 87-C-716, with the United States District Court in Colorado, 1988 and on. November 3rd of 1988, the Denver federal court system ruled that indeed the banks had defrauded the Bakervilles and proceeded to reverse the bankruptcy decision. But when the foreclosed property was not returned, they filed a new lawsuit. Eventually, 23 other farmers, ranchers, and Indians swindled by the banks in the same manner would join in the case. In these cases, the banks were foreclosing on the properties using fraudulent methods, such as charging exorbitant interest, illegal foreclosure, or by not crediting mortgage payments in their account, as they should have, but instead would steal the mortgage payments for themselves, triggering foreclosure on the property. After running out of money, they continued their fight without the help of lawyers. with some assistance by the Farmers Union, a new lawsuit was filed against the Federal Land Bank and the Farmers Credit System, case number 92-C-1781. The district court ruled in their favor and ordered the banks to return the stolen properties with help from either the federal marshals or the National Guard. But when no payments were made, the farmers declared involuntary Chapter 7 bankruptcy against the Federal Land Bank and the Farmer Credit System. The banks appealed their case, insisting they were not a business but a federal agency, therefore they were not liable to pay the damages. So the farmers' legal team adopted a new strategy. According to the Federal Land Bank's 1933 charter, they are not allowed to make loans directly to applicants, but instead could only back loans as a guarantor in the case of default. Because the Federal Land Bank had violated this rule, the farmer's legal team was able to successfully sue the bank for damages. Word of the lawsuit began to spread. The legal team would teach others how to fight foreclosure and help them file lawsuits as well. Case number 93-1308-M. Celebrities such as Willie Nelson joined in the cause and helped raise money during his Farm Aid concerts. Remember, they were trying to take him to jail for not paying his taxes? Maybe that really wasn't true. The Bakersville case had now become the Farmer Claims Case Action Lawsuit. Worried about the legal ramifications, the government retaliated against the farmers by hitting them with either outrageous IRS fees, sound familiar, or by imprisoning the legal team under frivolous, non-related charges. When the farmers realized they were being unfairly targeted, they had military generals such as General Roy Swasinger sit in the courtroom to make sure the bribe judges would vote according to constitutional law. The farmers now, with a large team of knowledgeable people of the law behind them, filed a new case to claim additional damages from the fraudulent loaning activities of the Federal Farmers Credit System. The government tried to settle, but they had already lost many cases and were now losing the appeals as well. More and more evidence was collected. According to the National Banking Act, all banks are required to register their charters with the Federal and State Bureau of Records, but none of the banks complied, allowing the legal team to sue the Farmers Credit System. Not only was Farmers Credit System not chartered to do business with the American Banking Association, but so were other quasi-government organizations, such as the Federal Housing Administration, the Department of Housing and Urban Development, and even the Federal Reserve Bank. Farmers Claims lawsuit was thrown out of court and each level with records purposefully destroyed. An example of these court cases may be viewed at openjuris.org. Look up Bakersville. 1990s. In the early 1990s, Roy Schwasinger brought the case before the United States Supreme Court. Some of the content of this case is sealed from public eyes, but most of it can be viewed today. The U.S. Supreme Court justices ruled that the Farmers Union claims were indeed valid. Therefore, all property foreclosed by the Farmers Credit System was illegal, and those who foreclosed on would have to receive damages. In addition, they ruled that the U.S. federal government and banks had defrauded the farmers of all U.S. citizens out of vast sums of money and property. Furthermore, the court ruled the shocking truth that the IRS was a Puerto Rican trust. Read more about that at www.supremelaw.org. There's also more information at www.globalresearch.ca. You can find more at www.apfn.net. That the income tax amendment was only ratified by 4 states and therefore was not a legal amendment. That the IRS code was not enacted into positive law within the Code of Federal Regulations. Positive law means the laws that have been enacted by a properly instituted and recognized branch of the government. You can read more about this at www.givemeliberty.org. that the U.S. government illegally foreclosed on farmers' homes with help from the federal agencies. Irrefutable proof was presented by a retired CIA agent. He provided testimony and records of the bank's illegal activities as further evidence that the Farmers Union claims were indeed legitimate. The implications of such a decision were profound. All gold, silver, and property titles taken by the Federal Reserve and IRS must be returned to the people. The legal team sought assistance from a small group of benevolent visionaries, consisting of politicians, military generals, and business people who have been secretly working to restore the Constitution since the mid-1950s. Somehow within their ranks, a 4-star U.S. Army general received title and receiver of the original 1933 United States bankruptcy. When the case was brought before the U.S. Supreme Court, they ruled in his favor, giving the Army general title over the United States Incorporated. Legal action was then passed on to the Senate Finance Committee, and Senator Sam Nunn, who was working with Roy Schlossinger in 1991, with the help of covert congressional and political pressure, President George H.W. Bush issued an executive order on October 23, 1991, which provided a provision allowing anyone who has a claim against the federal government to receive payment as long as it's within the rules of the original format of the case. You may read Executive Order Number 12778 at the URL below. Ethical Conduct for Government Officers and Employees on October 23, 1991 is the name of the executive order, and it's found at www.doh.state.fl.us. According to the Federal Reserve Act of 1913, all present and succeeding debts against the U.S. Treasury must be assumed by the Federal Reserve. Thus, the Farmers Claim legal team was able to use that executive order to not only force the Federal Reserve to pay out damages in a gold-backed currency, but also allow them to receive legal ownership over the bankruptcy of United States Incorporated. To collect damages, the farmers' legal team used an obscure attachment to the 14th Amendment, which most people are not aware of. After the Civil War, the government allowed citizens to claim a payment on anyone who suffered damages as a result of the federal government failing to protect its citizens from harm or damages by a foreign government. President Grant had his attachment sealed from public eyes, but somehow, someone on the farmers' legal team got a hold of it. If you read that carefully, it specifies damages by a foreign government. That foreign government is the corporate federal government by which has been masquerading to the public as a constitutional government, United States Incorporated. Remember, this goes back to the Organic Act of 1871 and the Trading with the Enemies Act of 1933. Which defined all citizens as enemy combatants under the federal system known as the United States. The justices and farmers' legal team recognized how evil and corrupt federal government had become, and to counteract this, they added some provisions in the settlement to bring the government back under control. A. First, they would have to be paid using a lawful currency backed by gold and silver as the Constitution dictates. This would eliminate inflation and gyrating economic cycles created by the Federal Reserve System. See Article 1, Section 10 of the U.S. Constitution. B. Second, they would be required to go back to common law instead of admiralty law under the gold fringe flags. Under common law, if there is no damage or harm done, then there is no violation of the law. This would eliminate millions of laws, which are used to control the masses and protect corrupt politicians. C. Lastly, the IRS would have to be dismantled and replaced with a national sales tax. This is the basis of Nassara law. When the legal team finally settled on a figure, each individual would receive an average of $20 million. Payout per claim multiplied by a total of 336,000 claims that were filed against the U.S. federal government. the total payout would come out to a staggering $6.6 trillion. The U.S. Supreme Court placed a gag order on the case, struck all information from the Federal Registry, and placed all records in the Supreme Court files. Up to that point, Senator Samnon had kept the Bakersville case records within his office. A settlement was agreed to out of court, and the decision was sealed by Janet Reno. Because the case was sealed, claimants are not allowed to share court documents to media outlets without violating the settlement, but they can still tell others about the lawsuit. This is why you probably have not heard about this. 1991. Roy Schlesinger went before a Senate committee to present evidence of the bankers and government criminal activity. He informed them of the Corporation of the United States and how it was tied to the establishment of a new world order, which would bring about a fascist one-world government ruled by the international bankers. In 1992, a task force was put together consisting of over 300 retired and 35 active U.S. military officers who strongly supported constitutional law. This task force was responsible for investigating government officials, congressional officers, judges, and the Federal Reserve. Chief of the Naval Operations, Admiral Jeremy Baruda, General David McLeod, former Director of Central Intelligence, William Colby. They uncovered the common practice of bribery and extortion committed by both senators and judges. The criminal activity was so rampant that only 2 out of 535 members of Congress were deemed honest. But more importantly, they carried out the first ever audit of the Federal Reserve. Federal Reserve was accustomed to giving orders to politicians and had no intention of being audited. However, after they were informed their offices would be raided under military gunpoint if necessary, they complied with the investigation. After reviewing their files, the military officers found $800 trillion sitting in the accounts, which should have been applied to the national debt. And contrary to federal government propaganda, they also discovered that most nations had in fact owed money to the United States instead of the other way around. These hidden trillions were then confiscated and placed into the European bank accounts in order to generate the enormous funds needed to pay the Farmers Claim Case Action lawsuit. This money would become the basis of the prosperity programs. Despite these death blows, President George H.W. Bush and the Illuminati continued on with their plans of global enslavement. In August of 1992, the military officers confronted President Bush and demanded he sign an agreement that he would return the United States to constitutional law and ordered him to never use the term New World Order again. Bush pretended to cooperate, but secretly planned to bring about the New World Order anyway by signing an executive order on December 25, 1992, that would have indefinitely closed all banks, giving Bush an excuse to declare martial law. Under the chaos of martial law, Bush intended to install a new constitution, which would have kept everyone currently in office in their same position for 25 years, and it would have removed all rights to elect new officials. The military intervened and stopped Bush from signing that executive order. In 1993, members of the Supreme Court, certain members of Congress, and representatives from the Clinton government met with high-ranking U.S. military officers who were demanding a return to constitutional law, reforms of the banking system, and financial redress. They agreed to create the Farm Claims Process, which would allow the legal team to set up meetings all over the country on a grassroots level to help others file claims and to educate them about the lawsuit. A claim of harm would be made on any loan issued by a financial institution for all interest paid, foreclosures, attorney and court fees, IRS taxes or liens, real estate and property taxes, mental and emotional stress caused by the loss of property, stress related to illness, such as suicide and divorce, and even warrants. Incarceration and probation could also be claimed. In 1994, but the Clinton government undermined their efforts by requiring the farm claims to use a specific form designed by the government. This form imposed an administrative fee of $300 for each claim, which was later used in 1994 as a basis to arrest the leaders of the legal team, including Roy Schwassinger. The government was so afraid of what they would say during their trial in Michigan that extra steps were taken to conceal the true nature of the case. County courthouse employees were not allowed to work between Monday and Thursday during the course of the trial. And outside the courthouse, FBI agents swarmed the perimeter, preventing the media and visitors from learning what was going on as well. Harassment and retaliation by the government increased. Many were sent to prison or murdered while incarcerated. Despite being protected by his military personnel, the Army general who acquired the original 1933 title of bankruptcy from the United States was imprisoned, killed, and replaced with a clone. This clone was then used as a decoy to prevent any further claims from being filed. Nancy adds, as a sidebar, I am not qualified to speak on the fact of human clones. However, that they exist is a fairly widely accepted fact among those who study behind-the-scenes activities. Don't allow the thought of clones running the government cause you to refuse to consider the veracity of this history. As truth emerges, we will be shocked at much we hear. During the first Clinton administration, the military delayed many of Clinton's federal appointments until they were sure these individuals would help restore constitutional law. One such individual who promised to bring about necessary changes was Attorney General Janet Reno, 1993. In agreement with the Supreme Court ruling on June 3, 1993, Janet Reno ordered the Delta Force and Navy SEALs to Switzerland, England, and Israel to recapture trillions of dollars of gold stolen by the Federal Reserve System from the Strategic Gold Reserves. These nations cooperated with the raid because they were promised their debts owed to the United States would be canceled, and because the people who stole the money from the United States also stole money from their nations as well. This bullion is to be used for the new currency backed by precious metals. It's now safely stockpiled at the NORAD complex at Colorado Springs, Colorado, and four other repositories. Janet Reno's actions so enraged the powers that be, it resulted in her death. She was then replaced with a clone, and it was this creature that was responsible for covering up the various Clinton scandals. Or should I say Hitlerian Clinton scandals. To keep the Secretary of U.S. Treasury, Robert Rubin, in line, he too was also cloned. For the remainder of their term in office, both Reno and Rubin received their salaries from the International Monetary Fund, the IMF, which is now run by Christine, who went to high school in Maryland and was handled from there as foreign agents and not from the U.S. Treasury. Despite these actions, the legal team continued on with their fight while managing to avoid bloodshed and major revolution. After 1993, the farmer claims process name was changed to bank claims. Between 1993 and 1996, the U.S. Supreme Court required U.S. citizens to file bank claims to collect the damages paid by the U.S. Treasury Department. This process closed in 1996. During this time, the U.S. Supreme Court assigned one or more justices to monitor the progress of the rulings. They enlisted the help of experts in economics, monetary systems, banking, constitutional government and law, and many other related areas. These justices built coalitions of support and assistance with thousands of people worldwide, known as White Knights. The term White Knights was borrowed from the world of big business. It refers to a vulnerable company that is rescued from a hostile takeover by a corporation or a wealthy person, a white knight. To implement the required changes, the five justices spent years negotiating how the reformations would occur. Eventually, they settled on certain agreements, also known as accords, with the U.S. government, the Federal Reserve Bank owners, the International Monetary Fund, World Bank, and numerous other countries, including the United Kingdom, and countries of the Eurozone. Because these U.S. banking reformations will impact the entire world, the IMF, the World Bank, and other countries had to be involved. The reformations require that the Federal Reserve be absorbed by the U.S. Treasury Department, and banks' fraudulent activities must be stopped and payment must be made for past harm. 1998. The military generals who originally participated in the farmers' claim process realized that the U.S. Supreme Court justices had no intentions of implementing the accords. So they decided the only way to implement the reformations was through a law passed by Congress. 1999. A 75-page document known as the National Economic Security and Reformation Act, NESARA, was submitted to Congress, where it sat with little action for almost a year. 2000, late one evening on March 9, 2000, a written quorum call was hand-delivered by Delta Force and Navy SEALs to 15 members of the U.S. Senate and the U.S. House who were sponsors and co-sponsors of NESARA. And those were the ones that I listed in the beginning that are known. They were immediately escorted by the Delta Forces and Navy SEALs to their respective voting chambers, where they passed the National Economic Security and Reformation Act. These 15 members of Congress were the only people lawfully allowed to hold office in accordance with the original 13th Amendment. In other words, they weren't attorneys. Remember, British soldiers destroyed copies of the titles of nobility. Amendment Tona in the War of 1812, because it prevented anyone who had ties to the Crown of England from holding public office. NESARA is the most groundbreaking reformation to sweep not only this country, but our planet in its entire history. The Act does away with the Federal Reserve Bank, the IRS, shadow government, and much more. NESARA implements the following changes. Number one, it zeroes out all credit card, mortgage, and bank debt due to illegal banking and government activity. This is the Federal Reserve's worst nightmare, a jubilee, or a forgiveness of debt. Number two, it abolishes the income tax. Number three, it abolishes the IRS. Employees of the IRS will be transferred to the U.S. Treasury National Sales Tax Area. Number four, it creates a 14% flat rate non-essential new items only sales tax revenue for the government. In other words, food and medicine will not be taxed, nor will it be used items, neither will it be used items such as old homes. Number five, it increases benefits to senior citizens. Number six, it returns constitutional law to all courts and legal matters. Number seven, it reinstates the original title of nobility amendment. Number eight, it establishes new presidential and congressional elections within 120 days after NESARA's announcement. The interim government will cancel all national emergencies and return us back to constitutional law. Number nine, it monitors elections and prevents illegal election activities of special interest groups. Number 10, it creates a new U.S. Treasury rainbow currency backed by gold, silver, and platinum, precious metals, ending the bankruptcy of the United States initiated by President Franklin Roosevelt in 1933. Number 11, it forbids the sale of American birth certificate records as chattel property bonds by the U.S. Department of Transportation. Number 12, it initiates new U.S. Treasury bank system in alignment with constitutional law. Number 13, it eliminates the Federal Reserve system. During the transition period, the Federal Reserve will be allowed to operate side by side of the U.S. Treasury for 1 year in order to remove all Federal Reserve notes from the money supply. Number 14, it restores financial privacy. Number 15, it retrains all judges and attorneys in constitutional law. Number 16, it ceases all aggressive U.S. government military actions worldwide. Number 17, it establishes peace throughout the world. Number 18, It releases enormous sums of money for humanitarian purposes. Number 19, it enables the release of over 6,000 patents of suppressed technologies which are being withheld from the public under the guise of national security, including free energy devices, anti-gravity, and sonic healing machines. October 10, 2000. Because President Clinton's clone had no interest in signing Nassar into law on October 10th of 2000, under orders from U.S. military generals, the elite naval SEALs and Delta Force stormed the White House and under gunpoint forced Bill Clinton to sign Nassar. Remember, everybody, he was a clone. During this time, Secret Service and White House security personnel were ordered to stand down, disarmed, and allowed to witness the event under a gag order. From its very inception, Bush Sr., the corporate government, major bank houses, and the Carlyle Group have opposed Nassar. To maintain secrecy, the case details and the docket number were sealed and revised within the official Congressional Registry to reflect a commemorative coin. And then again, it was revised even more recently. This is why there are no public congressional records and why a search for this law will not yield the correct details until after the reformations are made public. That's when President Obama announces it. Members of Congress will not reveal the Nassar because they have been ordered by the U.S. Supreme Court justices to deny its existence or face charges of treason punishable by death. Some members of Congress have actually been charged with obstruction. When Minnesota Senator Paul Wellstone was about to break the gag order, his small passenger plane, killing his wife, daughter, and himself. That was a very huge loss. I was living in Minnesota since before he died. If fear isn't enough to keep Washington in line, money is. Routine bribes are offered to governmental military officials by the power elite, secret government. Not surprisingly, much disinformation about Nassar can be found on the internet. Wikipedia's article is total disinformation. Dr. Harvey Francis Bernard's Nassar Bill, National Economic Stabilization and Recovery Act, was rejected by Congress in the 1990s. Dr. Bernard was a systems philosopher and had tried for years to interest Congress in his monetary reform suggestions. A testimony by Dr. Bernard's close friend, Daryl Anderson, may be read at www.simpleliberty.org. You may also read articles by Daryl Anderson at this site. Both men were interested in monetary reform. September 11th, 2001. Next step is to announce Nassar to the world, but it's not an easy task. Many powerful groups have tried to prevent the implementation of Nassar. The Nassar law requires that at least once a year an effort be made to announce the law to the public. Three then current U.S. Supreme Court judges control the committee in charge of Nassar's announcement. These judges have used their overall authority to secretly sabotage Nassar's announcement. In 2001, after much negotiation, Supreme Court justices ordered the 107th Congress to pass resolutions approving Nassar. This took place on September 9, 2001, 18 months after Nassar became law. On September 10, 2001, George Bush Sr. moved into the White House to steer his son on how to block the announcement. The next day, on September 11th, 2001, at 10 a.m. Eastern Daylight Time, Alan Greenspan was scheduled to announce the U.S. Treasury Bank System, debt forgiveness for all U.S. citizens, and abolishment of the IRS as the first part of the public announcements of Nassar. Just before the announcement, at 9 a.m., Bush Sr. ordered the demolition of the World Trade Center's Twin Towers to stop the international banking computers on floors 1 and 2 in the North Tower from initiating new U.S. Treasury bank system. Explosives in the World Trade Center were planted by operatives and detonated remotely in Building 7, which was demolished later that day in order to cover up their crime. Remote pilot technology was used to in a flyover event to deliver a payload of explosives into the Pentagon at the exact location of the White Knights and their new Naval Command Center, who were coordinating activities supporting Nisar's implementation nationwide. With the announcement of Nisar stopped dead in its tracks, George Bush Sr. decapitated any hopes of returning the government back to the people. For the past 10 years, life in the USA and numerous other countries has been dictated by the staged terrorist attacks and its repercussions. Seldom does a day go by that we do not hear mention of 9/11. 2005, Dr. Harry Bernard died on May 18, 2005. 2009, Roy E. Schwassinger Jr. died on August 23rd, 2009, at the age of 75. Exactly 2 years ago today. Verification, Social Security Death Index, ssdi.rootsweb.ancestry.com. Look up Schwassinger. 2011, the debt ceiling debacle kindled renewed interest in Nisar. As we watch the world economy collapse, we can know that Nisar law remains in the background, ready to be announced. Please tell everybody about Nisar law and that we're ready to announce it.
Okay, everybody. That was a kickback to 2011 when I recorded that. Thanks for letting me share it with you today. So, I guess we're doing things a little bit different today. I want to, it's my feeling that as we gather our intentions together to change the world, we're using collective consciousness to do that. So I want to share this video about consciousness to help us understand where we're going. Enjoy this. Thank you.
Tonight's talk is Consciousness, Creativity, and the Brain. And if you have a golf ball-sized consciousness, when you read a book, you'll have a golf ball size understanding. When you look out, a golf ball size awareness. And when you wake up in the morning, a golf ball size wakefulness. But if you could expand that consciousness, then you read the book, more understanding. You look out, more awareness. And when you wake up, more wakefulness. It's consciousness. And there's an ocean of pure, vibrant consciousness inside each one of us. And it's right at the source and base of mind, right at the source of thought, and it's also at the source of all matter.
There is no matter as such. All matter originates and exists only by virtue of a force which brings the particle of an atom to vibration and holds this most minute solar system of the atom together. We must assume behind this force the existence of a conscious and intelligent mind. This mind is the matrix of all matter.
Matter seems like a good place to begin. The solidity of the world seems totally indisputable. As a fixed thing that you can see and touch, your body is also reassuringly solid. But beginning with Einstein, modern physics has assured us that this solidity is a mirage.
All of physical matter, everything we have around us, is the result of a frequency. And what that also means is that if you amplify the frequency, the structure of the matter will change.
What this self-contained system is a hologram. It's what I call the super hologram. Everything within it is an expression of that hologram. This is one of the great characteristics of a hologram is that every part of a holographic picture is a smaller version of the whole.
It's as if reality is so connected that when you look at one small part, you can see things about other parts. The entire whole is contained in the part. And in a sense, you can't divide reality up because we're cutting up a hologram. We can't find where one particle is because it's always a reflection of all particles.
In a hologram, the whole pattern is whole and complete unto itself. And if you were to take any little portion of this whole out and examine it closely, you will see the entire pattern repeating itself again and again and again. Anywhere in this pattern, if we were to change one little aspect on any one of these little holograms, that change would be reflected throughout the entire system.
Quantum physics has revealed what ancient masters knew. Matter does not exist. The concept of substance arose from the philosophy of Aristotle. And from that concept came science's conception of matter. The fact of the matter is that the substance of the universe is consciousness. Belief that the substance of the universe is matter leads to what I call a fear-greed dichotomy. As people in their quiet desperation attempt to accumulate as many material possessions and riches as possible. In fact, the substance of the universe is consciousness. Therefore, it is behavior that is important.
If you get into the realms of fear, fear is a very slow, dense vibrational state. And the more you embody fear, and the whole of this manipulated society is globally is structured to make us fear, to make us have stress, to make us worry about tomorrow, and have guilt about yesterday, and forget about now. It brings us into a slow, vibrating, dense state.
We should be very careful about what we believe about the future. The more you attach to a belief system, the more, if reality is holographic, you're helping create it by believing it. And, you know, the great clairvoyant Edgar Cayce said that our every thought, that reality is built out of thought, and our every thought starts to build reality, and we're like, every thought is like a spider, we're like spider spinning web, and that web starts to build and build.
Information is the key. Because this matrix, this illusory reality that we think is real, people say to me, what is the matrix? Answer, it's information.
Information creates fractals. As information flow increases, the number of fractals, mathematically speaking, increase. This was demonstrated by a mathematician named Theodore Gordon. Fractals are unpredictable functions, so things are becoming more and more unpredictable.
When you start getting into fractals and chaos theory, when you look at it in terms of a society, this is where it starts to cross over into the so-called Illuminati or the negative elite, the world leaders with their philosophy of order out of chaos. There is some truth to that in the sense that when the system becomes highly destabilized, there will be random shifts that suddenly self-organize into higher complexity.
At the subatomic level, reality behaves in accordance with the expectation of the observer. Or the measurer, the scientist. Why is that remarkable? Because everything in the universe is composed of those subatomic particles.
These atoms are particles that are whirling at lightning speeds around huge empty spaces. And the particles aren't material objects. They are fluctuations of energy and information in a huge void of energy and information.
What the science now is showing is that when you can change the field, the atom is in, you change the atom. We're made of those atoms. So when we have feelings in our hearts, we're changing the field that connects the stuff everything is made of, and we literally are altering our physical reality.
Once you establish the reality we live in, and the nature of what the physical body is, it's a biological computer, and the nature of what we are, which is consciousness, and then you start, as I have, looking at the way this world is structured, and how it works, and why they do this, and why they do that, it suddenly brings into crystal clarity why the world is structured as it is. Because, you know, people look through their eyes and they think this is the world, but it isn't. It's a tiny, tiny frequency range within an infinite energy field of infinite frequency ranges. And basically, it's like a holographic television channel.
It is the act of consciousness that actually creates the building block the universe is made of. I can't imagine a universe that exists without us, because it's the act of us observing the world around us that is creating, allowing us to create as we go in a participatory universe. We may never find the edge of our universe as we're looking to define what this universe looks like. We may never find the smallest particle in the quantum world to see what this stuff is that we're made out of. And the reason is because everywhere we look, everywhere that consciousness explores with the expectation that something will be there, that exploration, that act of looking, observation, is the act to create something for us to see. That we are actually building this universe as we go.
Consciousness is the programming language of the universe. We are consciousness conductors. That's what we do. That's who we are. Mm. Consciousness comes through us. It emanates from us. We are the creators. We are the ones who are targeted on this planet, because we are the ones who transmit the reality just like everybody else does. If you switch your brain off and you are sucked into the mainstream media illusion, we must understand that we are being used, because we create reality. So if we are manipulated in a certain way, and if we are modulated in a certain way, then our creation becomes not ours but somebody else's.
And what happens if we hold it, everyone in this room decides to take control of reality? I'm talking about reality, I'm talking about quantum physics, I'm talking about taking control of things from the quantum level up, from the molecular level up, and it works. One of the things we're actually dealing with is some, as I say, some kind of operating system that can be hacked using words.
The world is like a ride at an amusement park, and when you choose to go on it, you think it's real, because that's how powerful our minds are. The ride goes up and down and round, it has thrills and chills, and it's very brightly colored, and it's very loud, and it's fun for a while. Some people have been on the ride for a long time, and they begin to question, is this real, or is this just a ride? And other people have remembered, and they come back to us, and they say, hey, don't worry, don't be afraid, ever, because this is just a ride.
Okay. Thank you, everybody, for joining me today. Let's finish up the day with a meditation. And by the way, happy spring. This meditation is called Merging with Your Avatar. And this is a throwback of mine from 2010. Enjoy this.
Hi, everybody. This is Beth from GalacticRoundtable.com. I would like to do a guided meditation with you today, and this is to merge with your avatar.
Sorry. Let me try this again.
From GalacticRoundtable.com. I would like to do a guided meditation with you today, and this is to merge with your avatar. All of us have our own avatar body. Some have an angelic avatar, which looks like a bright sun. We are all sons and daughters, and sons in our light body. We are all children of Ra. Your avatar is the ascended part of you. There are many different aspects of your ascended body. You are human and divine. You are an angelic and galactic and human. You may see an avatar which is angelic, lion people, bird people, reptilian people, Bigfoot people. You may have blue skin, green skin, or any of hundreds of species from star systems outside our galaxy. Your avatar is the part of yourself which is dedicated to selfless spiritual service and brings divine messages to you and those around you. It is your higher self and another aspect of you. It is time to remember your true form and remember the master you are. We begin this meditation by centering our focus. Take some deep breaths into your heart center. This relaxes your mind and lights your heart, Merkava, for travel. Please repeat this meditation as often as you would like. Use this to come in contact with your personal avatar. This is the essential beginning of being a cosmic master and remembering your siddhas. Siddhas are your multidimensional abilities, and we will remember these together. You perform these while in your avatar body. Please take some deep breaths. Close your eyes and imagine you are standing on the Giza Plateau in Egypt. We are standing at the base of the Sphinx, and in the distance we see the Great Pyramid and the other pyramids. Look into the sky and stare at the sun. It does not hurt to look into the sun. It feels good as it lights your third eye between your brows. You see a bright white and pale yellow sun. Suddenly it morphs and you see the sun behind the sun. The sunlight turns magenta and gold and you are seeing a beautiful warm pink sunlight. This is Helios and Vesta welcoming you to this sacred place. Now walk between the paws of the Sphinx. Walk right up to the breastplate over the heart of the Sphinx. You will see a rose quartz breastplate. Turn around and let your spine press up against the rose quartz over the heart of the Sphinx. Let your hands feel the cool quartz crystal behind you. This is a portal. Now you feel the Kundalini energy in your spine ignited and raising up to your head. And there is a light explosion as you go out through the 13th gateway of your third eye and crown. And you zoom up, up, out past Earth's atmosphere to the bright, bright stars and the space and the night sky. And you are floating there, smiling, feeling good, looking at the stars. We are all out here safely floating together. Before us now, we see our avatar. You may see it or hear it, and some will feel it. Sense your avatar here in this very relaxing place. You are now seeing your true self. You are happy. It feels good to remember. You are laughing at the memory. You always thought this, but now you know it is true. Now your avatar and you come together and you merge together. And as you do this, you are becoming one with your highest self. You now have all of your multidimensional talents and traits inside your human body. You are ready to rediscover these siddhas. You are ready to fly home. Now, as you are merged with your avatar, you float gently back down into your body, back at the Sphinx. You remember everything you saw in great detail. You may write it down, browse it, read about it, and come into deeper and deeper understanding of your species and your true galactic heritage. With deep gratitude, we thank our guides and our avatar for this tremendous gift of remembrance. Namaste. This is Beth.
Okay, I think that wraps it up for today. Thank you for indulging me on the little change. Tomorrow we'll go back to our regular programming, and we'll be looking at the Citizens Hearing on Disclosure, witness Donald Schmidt. So have a wonderful day, and come back and see me tomorrow. Namaste, everybody.